Welcome to New Books in Asian American Studies. I'm your host, Ian Shin. Today on our podcast, we have Professor Allison Varsali speaking about her book, Children of Reunion, Vietnamese Adoptions and the Politics of Family Migrations, published in 2017 by the University of North Carolina Press. Allison Varsali is professor of history at Cal State Fullerton, where she teaches and does research on histories of immigration, multiracial relations, the American West, and the Asian American experience. This is Professor Varsali's second book. Her first was Making a Non-White America, Californians Coloring Outside Ethnic Lines, published in 2008 by the University of California Press. I really enjoyed reading Children of Reunion and speaking about it with Professor Varsali, and I hope that you enjoy our conversation. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Asian American Studies. I am Ian Shin, one of the hosts of the channel. Today, we are talking to Allison Varsali about her new book, Children of Reunion, Vietnamese Adoptions and the Politics of Family Migrations. This book was published in 2017 by the University of North Carolina Press. Allison is professor of history at Cal State Fullerton. Allison, welcome to our show.
Oh, thank you so much, Ian. I'm excited for our conversation.
Great. I am as well. Allison, I wonder if we could start the conversation by having you tell us a little bit about yourself and where you're from.
Sure. So I was born in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, in the 1970s, which I guess has some relevance to my book that focuses upon that decade. And it's also a city where Vietnamese were resettled in significant numbers. But I grew up there. All my family is from Pennsylvania, and I did my graduate work at UCLA. So coming to California was a new experience, and I felt a bit foreign, but soon enough fell in love with the state. And I was really interested in immigration history, partially because of my own experience. So my grandparents came from Eastern Europe, and I think that the immigrant story is different in California because of the variety of immigrant groups and the strong presence of Asian immigration. So I focused upon the history of American West, but immigrants within the West, including Asian immigrants, for my dissertation. And then that dissertation became the basis of my first book that looked at the civil rights struggles of many minorities in California, who often were clustered in the same neighborhoods because of restrictive housing covenants and limitations in education and employment. But I found that out of that kind of proximity in the 30s and 40s came really interesting kind of cultural combinations and friendships and marriages and even some collective organizing to challenge shared forms of discrimination that had some successes in toppling the legal supports of discrimination in California, especially in marriage, education, and employment. And then I continued to look at immigration. This current project kind of drifts a little bit from that. It's no longer contained to California, even if California hosts large Vietnamese populations. But I think immigration has been kind of the theme of my work over time.
I see. And did you have any interactions with the Vietnamese refugees who were resettled in the Philadelphia area growing up? You mentioned that you were aware that there were some there, but was this a topic that had sort of entered your consciousness, you think, earlier on? Or how did you come to, the subject of the book of Children of Reunion?
Yeah, you know, I think in the 1970s, I wasn't completely aware of their presence, but then on retrospect, I remember that there were a couple of Vietnamese students in my classes. They came in high school. And also I remember one of my family members through their Catholic church had been briefly housing Vietnamese refugees. So I might not have been thinking about it at the time, but I wonder in some ways whether that kind of shaped my interest. Many of the Vietnamese adoptees and Amerasians who I interviewed for the book are close to my age. So I think there is that personal connection of growing up through a period that was defined in part by memories of the Vietnam War. And of course, Vietnamese memories are different than American memories, but I think that was an impetus. But I think the broader origins of the book came from a curiosity about families as a site of social and political change. And I guess in my first book, I looked at a number of interracial families that were formed despite kind of cultural and sometimes legal prohibitions against kind of interracial marriages. And I was curious about what the larger implications of those kind of families and their children were. So I think I had come across a couple of cases of, you know, Vietnamese adoptees, and most of these Vietnamese children were adopted into white middle-class families. So I think I became curious about what that meant and whether those families altered kind of the meanings of the refugee struggle and the Vietnam War itself.
Right.
I think I also, another maybe line of continuity is my interest in kind of celebrating and highlighting the stories of people in the kind of attack. So I relied in my work often on oral histories as a kind of source material that gets at very kind of personal and intimate truths that you might not find through other sources. And then I've really tried to emphasize those oral histories within the text. That was a key part of the project.
Right. Did you get to know, you'd mentioned that some of the Vietnamese and Amerasian adoptees that you spoke to were your own age. Have you gotten to know a fairly large community of them? Are you still in touch with networks of them as you have finished and begin to publicize this book?
I am, and I have, and I think what facilitated the work is that this is a kind of a population that, as they kind of came of age, I think in their 20s and especially the 30s, were increasingly interested in their own stories and telling those stories in kind of diverse ways and reconnecting with one another. And the model, I think, of Korean adoptees was illustrative for Vietnamese. And of course, the Korean adopted community is much larger than the Vietnamese adopted community. But I think that suggested the possibility of finding those who had had kind of a shared experience and were wondering about, you know, birth families, birth relatives in Vietnam, or that had come to the United States, or might be interested in returning to Vietnam as part of a kind of heritage experience. So I was able to kind of tap into those communities, I think, more readily because they were Vietnamese kind of adoptees and Amerasians were finding one another. And I think new forms of social media make that so much easier. I think some of the adoptees certainly found that there was this powerful commonality of being adopted and being asked about the Vietnam War and wondering about Vietnam. But I think they often found that there were enough lines of kind of disconnection based upon kind of where they'd grown up and their socioeconomic background and such. But I'm curious also, since a number of them are active not only in kind of sustaining a Vietnamese adopted community, but advocating for reunions with Vietnamese relatives and American fathers. There's attempts also to assure the citizenship rights of Amerasians who were given kind of privileged immigration status under the Amerasian Homecoming Act, but weren't given kind of the rights of U.S. citizenship at that time. So I'm trying to kind of stay connected and see what's happening among that group.
I think we'll talk more about your sense of these adoptees and their search for, as you put it in the fourth chapter, sort of their place in the world and their connections to families both here in the U.S. and in Vietnam. We'll talk more about that as we talk about chapter four. But I really find that, especially the part where you talk about the ways in which new technologies have enabled you to do research, but also enabled them to find those connections, really brings that story to our current moment. I wonder then if as we've already started talking a little bit about some of the other narratives that are out there about Asian adoptees in the United States and the histories of those adoptees. You mentioned the Korean adoptees, which is a much larger group, as you said, in terms of numbers. You and I have exchanged some emails where we sort of talked quickly about some of the other books that are currently out there. In fact, there seems to be sort of some recent interest in adoptees and families, as you said, as a site of politics. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how you see this literature shaping up and what in particular, at a very broad level, Children of Reunion adds to that conversation and that historiography.
Oh, sure. I think that there is really wonderful emergent literature. I think most strikingly, Catherine Cezina Choi's book about global families and Emerso Oh's work on Korean adoption and Suzy Wu. And I think so Vietnamese adoptions is part of that larger history of Americans and probably Europeans and Australians too, adopting children from Asia and just adopting foreign children. That is a relatively, I think, new phenomenon, really dating to the middle of the 20th century and World War II, when Americans were trying to care for European refugee children who had been displaced by conflict there. But I think there's also a larger kind of shift in American practice of how they're understanding the place of foreign children. And driven by both kind of political and humanitarian impulses, Americans have sent kind of aid to children in kind of struggling regions. I think that's a long historical pattern. But I think after World War II, increasingly Americans are thinking about not just kind of sending assistance and supporting kind of social welfare structures in the home countries, but maybe bringing those children to the United States. And part of that is a sense of what the United States could offer these children in terms of kind of material benefits and democratic values, but also just frankly, a heightened demand for children as fertility rates fall in the United States, and having a child out of wedlock is less of a social stigma. So, single mothers can hold on to their children. So I think part of this is a demand and supply story. And then in terms of where Americans are looking for kind of children to expand their families, realize that kind of very private personal need, but maybe sometimes also express their political ideas, they're looking to Asia because the United States is increasingly involved in Asia in a way of violence and in a way of social aid. So the Vietnamese story kind of picks up on Americans thinking about Asian children. And I should say Americans are often thinking about Asian girls in particular. And there's, others have talked about that representation of the docile Asian girl who will maybe more readily fit into these American families. So when the Vietnam War kind of breaks out and Americans discover Vietnam, they find it on the map. In some ways, they're kind of primed to think about rescuing Vietnamese children. But I find what's different, I think, about the Vietnamese case is that Americans are increasingly critical of U.S. foreign policy. So the growing kind of frustration and anger about how this war is unfolding and how the United States government is conducting itself, I think, shapes the adoption story. So a lot of these American parents, when they're reaching out as part of their anti-war sentiment. So this is not a fulfillment of American foreign policy, I think, as it was in the Korean and sometimes the Chinese case, where American parents saw themselves as forwarding the U.S. anti-communist crusade by helping these poor, desperate children who would lapse in these communist countries or possibly communist countries. In Vietnam, they're often saying, the United States has made a mess here, right? And so we're embarrassed and we want to make good where our nation has misstepped. So that seems different in the Vietnamese case. I think it's also that these Vietnamese adoptees are migrating during and just before this major wave of Vietnamese refugees, right? And so I think to think of them as a kind of refugee, whether they were self-conscious or not about it, is a different way of understanding, I think, their adoption, and also trying to understand them as part of this Vietnamese refugee experience and what Vietnamese refugees are struggling with, the kind of claims that they make on the United States or attempt to make on the United States, and then just the broader conflict between, I think, the United States and Vietnamese about the kind of the legacies of the war and what the United States owes kind of Vietnam for kind of the violence that it participated in there.
Yeah, so what you said, I think, really helps us understand the first chapter of Children of Reunion. So the idea of almost adoption as a form of war protest or disagreement with the war aims, right? That that's in your first chapter, which is entitled Vietnamese Adoptions in the Early War Years, that's sort of the underpinning of how Americans, especially those on the left, begin to see adoption, the adoption of Vietnamese children. I wonder if it was true that if that's the case, do you think, and I wasn't able to find this in the book, but I wonder if, does that mean that Vietnamese children were more likely to have grown up in politically liberal families? If this is sort of the, rhetoric and discourse out of which their adoption emerged? Or do you think it actually did range across the entire political spectrum? I wonder if, I guess, if there's sort of a political divide, right, in how Asian adoptions occurred between the more sometimes religiously motivated, the Christian fundamentalistically motivated adoption of Korean children versus, say, in this case, the kind of radical war protest adoption of Vietnamese children?
That's a great question. And I didn't kind of quantify the political leanings of the adoptive parents. I think what I did notice is that there was a clear and kind of strong presence of liberal-leaning parents who were making their anti-war kind of politics part of their explanation of adoption, that were not part of an earlier kind of adoption case from kind of Korea or China. I definitely think that there is a kind of persistence, though, as you're suggesting, among maybe more religious conservatives, those who were supportive of the war, who were also adopting Vietnamese children, who saw these images on the television. A lot of the adoptive parents talked about this imagery of poor, desperate-looking children and feeling a religious or a kind of humanitarian kind of pull to adopt them. So I think that that's maybe an uneven answer to your question. Part of this is based upon the sources. Among the sources that I looked at, and we might talk about this later, are the records of these anti-war groups that are housed at Swarthmore, particularly the Friends Meeting for the Suffering of Vietnamese Children and the Committee of Responsibility. And they are kind of Quaker-based groups that have kind of a broader membership. But they're deeply critical of the war, and they're talking about Vietnamese children very early on in the 1960s and how to kind of help them. And there's some actually before adoption is recommended, and there is actually some dispute among these kind of liberal-leaning Americans about whether adoption is always the right answer and whether it might not be better to provide kind of medical care and other services with these Vietnamese so they're not taken away from their Vietnamese families. And that seems to be a change in the kind of the rhetoric or thinking about adoption too. Not that there isn't a persistence of a maybe more kind of conservative idea that when you adopt these Vietnamese children, they will become American and should become American through kind of teaching English very quickly, and they're learning baseball or other you know, traditional ideas of American white identity. But I think that the adoptive parents are also thinking, how do we preserve Vietnamese culture? How do we make our kind of children understand where they're from? And that seems different than I think an earlier generation of adoptive parents who are much more focused on how do we assimilate and integrate these children, again, make them kind of adopt white American norms as quickly as possible.
Right, right. I guess shifting gears a little bit to another part of that first chapter, you also talk about the sort of gendering of especially the role of U.S. soldiers in this case by portraying them as caring fathers rather than as sort of brutal warriors, which had been their kind of reputation coming out of the Vietnam War. So how does that process happen? And what is the history there?
Yeah, no, that seems really kind of important to understanding kind of the participation and the representation of American soldiers, many of whom are the fathers or suspected fathers of some of these Vietnamese who are children who are in kind of orphanages and will be adopted by American families. And you know, there's other historians who've talked about the ways in which the U.S. government tried to moderate the image of the brutal American soldier as a way of kind of explaining or justifying U.S. intervention in the region. And there is criticism of American GIs for abusing Vietnamese women or for taking too lightly their kind of paternal responsibilities if their father children in Vietnam. But I think there's also this history that is maybe less talked about of American kind of GIs and American men who are working in other capacities in Vietnam who are accepting that kind of position of father, whether they are the fathers of these Vietnamese children or not, and that's a way for them to kind of ease their own, I think, discomforts with the war and the violence of the war, right? That is seen kind of on the bodies of these children. And in the book, one of the cases that I found really kind of persuasive and powerful was that of Ken and Ree Armstrong. And Ken is this American GI and medic who encounters Ree, this young, actually Cambodian boy, though, who was found in Vietnam and brought into a U.S. hospital, and he's lost his leg. And Ken is in the hospital and is just completely charmed by this boy, whose family has also kind of disappeared and likely died in the conflict. And Ken becomes an advocate for the boy and tries to adopt him, which is actually extremely difficult. I think the other part of this story is the ways in which single Americans who are trying to adopt find themselves stymied both by the U.S. military and the U.S. government, and sometimes the Vietnamese government, who's not supportive of those kinds of parenting arrangements. So Ken actually ultimately has to use his own parents as a kind of proxy adopter so that he can adopt Ree. And it's a kind of a long kind of struggle and story. But I think his case does suggest another understanding of how American men are involved in this adoption story, because it's often framed as, you know, the Vietnamese woman and the American adoptive mother, right? That the kind of this white American is kind of longing for a child, or is rather critical of the Vietnam War, or driven by humanitarian desires, takes this baby from the Vietnamese woman, and the men are often kind of sidelined or absent. So I found that men were actually more central in these kind of decisions to adopt and to take these Vietnamese children than we might have thought.
And for those who are interested in Looking at the book later on, I will say that there is a totally charming picture of Rhee and Ken Armstrong in a field hospital in Vietnam in 1969 in the book as one of many wonderful illustrations of this history in Children of Reunion. Allison, I wonder if we can now turn to talk a little bit about Chapter 2. I think we've sort of set a nice sort of foundation for understanding of this history in the early part of the Cold War. And Chapter 2 is entitled After the Airlifts, which it centers really on Operation Baby Lift and the sort of response to Operation Baby Lift which happened in 1975. I think some folks may be familiar with Operation Baby Lift and the kind of publicity stunts that came out of President Ford at the airport in San Francisco with babies coming off of the plane. But for those who aren't as familiar, can you give us a little bit on what Operation Baby Lift was and why it was so potent as a symbol of American reaction and response to Vietnam?
Sure, absolutely. And this is definitely the most dramatic and, as you suggested, I think familiar episode in the larger history of Vietnamese adoptions. But I think it is rightfully kind of familiar and dramatic. So the airlifts take place in 1975 and are really part of a larger attempt by the U.S. government to depart Vietnam as the North Vietnamese kind of descend into the South and seize control. And it is over kind of 2,000 Vietnamese children are flown out of Vietnam. The majority of them are actually processed at San Francisco's Presidio, the military outpost, about 1,500. It is dramatic because I think of the scale of the removal and because of the participation of the U.S. government. And also one of the first kind of planes that takes off actually crashes and half of those on the plane die, right? So there's just a lot of kind of agony and loss here. What's also kind of striking is the immediate reaction to Operation Baby Lift. And if you look at kind of the media accounts and certainly the government's representation of Operation Baby Lift, this is seen as an example of Americans kind of making right by a bad war, right? That these are kind of innocent and sometimes kind of damaged children that the United States have rescued, that this is an expression of our kind of benevolence and might be a way that we can feel good about a war that few Americans have felt good about. But it becomes clear that this Operation Baby Lift might have other kind of implications. And instead of kind of settling an account of what this war means for the United States, it just continues to churn those meanings. So at the Presidio, there's a couple of volunteers, Vietnamese-speaking volunteers, who are having conversations with the more mature Vietnamese children and realize that maybe these children are not orphans, that they might have family in the United States that they're trying to connect to, or that they got separated from family in Vietnam who did not authorize their relinquishment. And from those cases, a lawsuit is filed charging the U.S. government, kind of key officials, including Kissinger, with airlifting or taking these children who were not legitimate orphans. And there's a really painful class action suit that unfolds in which Vietnamese refugees are brought to the fore to tell their stories of how they suffered through the war and may have not intended the abandonment or the relinquishment of their children, but saw the airlift as part of a larger kind of strategy of getting out of Vietnam and hopefully reconnecting with their families.
Yeah, so the lawsuit that you're mentioning, which I'll note for listeners, is Nguyen Da Yen et al., the Kissinger et al., is, I think that the parts of the book or of Chapter 2 where you write about this lawsuit were some of the most heartrending because you see not only the kind of resourcefulness and humanity of the Vietnamese women, who are, I think as you write on page 57, individuals making tough but deliberate choices amid arduous circumstances, right? So they're sort of really inventive in the ways in which they're trying to keep their families together in the long term, as you said. But then also these the responses on the other sides, where you have groups like the Council for Rights of Adoptive Families, who are making I think it's hard to read them without being a little bit angry. I felt in some of the arguments they were trotting out against the Vietnamese mothers, saying that they had not taken good care of their children because they had poor oral health and other health issues. So can you maybe spin out both sides of this lawsuit for us a little bit, in terms of who the players were involved and sort of the emotional content and weight that really comes out of Nguyen V. Kissinger?
Sure. No, it's really kind of agonizing because I think both sides are in a position of such kind of pain and uncertainty, right? So the lawsuit is filed for the Center for Constitutional Rights that is situated in New York. But among the key players are actually these Bay Area attorneys, among them Tom Miller, who is married to a Vietnamese woman who is a self-proclaimed revolutionary. The couple are still kind of active in all kinds of liberal causes. I was able to interview them for the book. But Nguyen is also at the Presidio. She's one of the women who comes to doubt whether all these children are orphans and familyless. So the suit is filed, and the plaintiffs who are trying or claiming to be apolitical are very much against the war, right? And that seeps into their arguments. And I think that it might affect how the judge kind of interprets their arguments and the evidence. But what they have to kind of support their assertions are, they kind of investigate, they do a series of interviews with the Vietnamese children who were adopted, and they have a list of names of those whose paperwork is uncertain. They also find specific Vietnamese mothers who have come to the United States and are trying to find their children and say that they have been blocked by U.S. officials, some of whom have been completely insensitive to their cases. There's one example of a Vietnamese woman who's asking around in Camp Pendleton, and she claims that the government officials say, have another child, right? That's the solution to her loss. But a number of these Vietnamese women, and it's not just mothers, sometimes it's, aunts or grandparents who were entrusted with trying to recover these Vietnamese children because their mothers remained in Vietnam, that they're testifying that these children are not orphans, that in fact that they were placed in orphanages as a kind of safe space and temporary space, and that Americans don't really understand the complexity and the breadth of Vietnamese family connections, that you take care of your own, whether it's your kind of immediate kin or not. On the other side, though, you have the adoption agencies and the adoptive parents who are saying, wait a second, these children were legitimately relinquished, that we did try to consider the real concerns of these Vietnamese mothers and kin who begged us to take their children to the United States. They also say, it was so chaotic by the 1975, that if they don't have the right paperwork, it's only because it was impossible and that they were concerned with just the survival of these children. Others, of course, also especially these adoptive parents, many of whom who had no idea of the circumstances under which these children came to them, are saying, well, we've fallen in love with this child, that they've become part of our family, that they are readily adapting to, quote, American ways. And there's various evidence of that, from a child's love of hamburgers to a child's love of baseball. And so the judge is trying to kind of suss out these starkly competing claims, and in the end decides that it's too muddied, too complex, that maybe there's not enough evidence to support a class action suit. So he tosses out the case, and that leads a number of Vietnamese families to just have to pursue their cases individually. And kind of Tom Miller and his forces support some of those efforts that are successful. I found probably five or six kind of high-profile cases where the Vietnamese families, after the class action suit, are able to recover their Vietnamese children. And that's heartbreaking for the American families, too. So there's no kind of clear winner in this story, I think, as is the case with all kind of custody battles. But you see the ways in which the larger kind of conflict of the Vietnam War is played out through the frame of the family.
Yeah, it really does seem like this lawsuit, you know, should be part of any discussion that we now have about the legal history of Asian Americans and Asians in the United States, because it is such a complex issue. We've so far talked mostly in terms of the Vietnamese adoptees, of folks who are whose parents both were of Vietnamese origin. You have a third chapter, which is entitled Amerasians, Families, and Hopes of Homecoming, which is about a slightly different group of adoptees that are called Amerasians. I wonder if you could help us understand why it's important to distinguish between the Amerasian experience and the Vietnamese adoptee experience.
Sure. Part of it is timing, right? So that third chapter looks at kind of Amerasians who have grown up in Vietnam, and have often struggled because of their mixed identity. And I think others have written about the kind of the struggles of this population in the absence of their American fathers, that they are often kind of suspect, that there is certainly a racial prejudice that prevails in Vietnam. There's also, I think, an understanding that these children represent the enemy or represent kind of U.S. power, the abuse of U.S. power in the area. Often the Vietnamese women, even if these were consensual relationships and loving relationships with American men, and often long-lasting relationships with American men, it's often seen and misunderstood that these women were somehow licentious and sexually available and are women of ill repute. And all those kind of bad feelings and misunderstandings are complicating the lives of Amerasians. And so in their accounts, growing up in Vietnam, they talk often about their mothers, first of all, trying to disguise their American features, right? So, you know, adding color to their hair, right, to darken it, or not being able to just go to school because the taunting is so ferocious. So this is a group, I guess I argue, that could have been, might have been adopted in the 1960s and 1970s, because many of those who adopted in that period were likely Amerasians. And in my interviews with them, they say, I think I am, I'm not sure, I don't know who my father is, I'm not sure who my biological father and mother are. But Amerasians who've grown up in Vietnam, by the 1980s, there is a growing kind of campaign that is driven, I think, by Amerasians, by the Vietnamese families, but also by American GIs and some American legislators who are noting what has happened to them or the kind of their struggles in Vietnam. And in the 1980s, Americans are still talking about fretting over the Vietnam War and what it means. They're often talking less about what it means for Vietnam, but what does it mean for Americans? So out of that kind of talk and continued uncertainty about the war, there is legislation proposed to bring kind of Amerasian youth to the United States. And the first iteration of the bill in 1982 is kind of striking because it will favor Amerasian youth, but doesn't see them as youth who have family members. So it doesn't allow their mothers or other close kin to immigrate with them. The result is that very few Amerasians take advantage of that legislation. So the U.S. legislators kind of go back and negotiate and hatch the second and more impactful law, the Amerasian Homecoming Act in 1988. And that results in a kind of a large wave of Amerasians and their family members. That law allows them to bring their kind of close relations with them, or at least a select number of their close relations. So those Amerasians are coming to the United States as kind of young adults. Many of the arguments, though, that were made in favor of the Amerasian Homecoming Act often by Americans often pictured and treated the Amerasians as kind of children who were familyless and needed to be, again, rescued, that were American rather than Vietnamese because of their American fathers, and that this, maybe much like the airlift and the broader adoption of Vietnamese children, could be the last and final apology for kind of a war that had gone wrong. So in terms of kind of the rhetoric that justifies the legislation, the conception of these Amerasians as children, I see that as connected to the earlier adoption story.
Yeah, and I should note for listeners that in terms of just numbers, I think you write that roughly 20,000 Amerasians arrived in the United States between 1982 and 1993. Interestingly, you know, 5,000 of those, so almost a quarter, were of African-American parentage, which is an interesting story. Before we talk about that, though, I think one of the things that struck me as I was reading this particular chapter was how, because of the Amerasian Homecoming Act's provision for families to come over with the adoptees, or to be brought over to the United States with the adoptees, first of all, the sort of resonances with family reunification debates that we're having today is very strong. As you write, the family unity sort of principle that is defined as a humanitarian concern is fairly restricted, right? So they didn't want to draw the circle of family too widely, even though they do recognize that families are important. But one of the things that show up in that case is you write about these sort of families of convenience or families of opportunity, you know, that are constructed in order to take advantage of this provision. And one of the things that happens is that there are sort of real psychological costs and social costs to that kind of agency, because when those families do come to the United States, there are sort of consequences in terms of breaking down, people feeling like they've been taken advantage of, et cetera. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about sort of the ways in which people live out these pieces of legislation that are written in the 1980s to help sort of Amerasians come to, and their families come to, the United States and build lives here.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I think as Amerasians kind of win this kind of privileged status or privileged opportunity of coming to the United States, there are other kind of Vietnamese who are not related to Amerasians who try to curry favor with Amerasians. They too want to come to the United States, see that I think that the language is that these Amerasians are a kind of golden ticket. So often they will purchase kind of the price of kinship, right? So essentially the Amerasian would agree to pretend familial relations, right? Whether this be this other Vietnamese be kind of a son or a daughter or kind of a spouse. And so they play the part of kind of family in these resettlement camps, right? The Amerasians have to kind of spend significant time there being kind of indoctrinated or educated in American ways before landing in the United States. But there are quite a number of cases where that these families of convenience become really places or spaces of kind of painful conflict, right? The Amerasians talk about the ways in which they are abused by these kind of fictitious kin, both in the resettlement camps and also when they reach the United States. And that is deeply troubling kind of psychologically. And there are cases kind of abuse once they reach the United States and the fictive families now have gotten where they want to get and kind of disappear, leaving the Amerasian alone. Certainly not all Amerasians kind of came to the United States with those kind of fictitious kin. Some came with their own families. I think the struggle sometimes for Amerasians is there was an expectation on their part and the Americans' part that, again, if the justification for the Amerasian Homecoming Act is that we're essentially bringing American children home, that they're not really Vietnamese, then that their settlement in the United States will be kind of quick and easy, right? That these aren't foreigners and that they shouldn't have the same level of kind of support that other refugees might have. So when it becomes the case that in fact these Amerasians, who many of whom do not speak English and are not kind of culturally American, are struggling, then the rhetoric turns towards, oh, was this a mistake, or is this one more example of how we can't settle the war? I think though. I also found, though, in my research, as much as Amerasians were often kind of understood as another kind of struggling immigrant population over time, the Amerasians themselves showed a level of kind of agency and organization as they kind of found one another, as they kind of remigrated to communities where there were large Vietnamese populations already. There's an Amerasian network led by kind of Jimmy Miller and a few others that advocates for Amerasian issues. Amerasians advocates for Amerasians that are still in Vietnam and tries to sometimes facilitate connections between Amerasians and their Vietnamese families already in the United States or their American fathers.
I think this is a part of the book that will speak really nicely to the scholarship that we're beginning to see on mixed race or Hapa Asian Americans and sort of give an earlier account of how one part of that community came to be. But I think for now I'd love to turn to chapter 4, which is entitled Living Legacies. And for me, the theme that really emerged out of this chapter was the question, who speaks for Vietnamese adoptees? There are so many different organizations in the beginning of the 90s that start to try to reconnect Vietnamese adoptees to their homeland and to their families in Vietnam, running heritage tours, some of which seem potentially commercially exploitative and questionable in ethics. But then the Vietnamese adoptees also themselves begin to form organizations that take their own personal histories and family histories into their own hands. So I wonder if you could maybe speak to that theme. Who speaks for Vietnamese adoptees in the 1990s? And I guess that also requires us to think a little bit too as Asian American studies scholars about how we are also participating in that overall project as we narrate that history.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And certainly by the 1990s, these Vietnamese adoptees and Amerasians are kind of old enough and familiar enough, I think, with American history to be making claims on their own behalf in a way that they certainly weren't during the 1970s, when there's so much talking about these kind of children and what these children mean for Vietnamese refugees and Americans, but the children are largely the objects of the discussion, not the subject. So I think as Vietnamese are joining the conversation in the 1990s, and that's also importantly a decade when the United States relationship with Vietnam is normalized. So Americans are beginning to think differently about Vietnam as kind of a country and the place of U.S. violence there. But I think these adoptees are certainly an incredibly diverse group. I think that was striking in terms of their socioeconomics, their location, their sexuality, their politics. But they did have, many of them had this kind of shared desire to know something about their past. And then in knowing something about their own past, that became kind of political, and that they were arguing against this idea of adoptees as grateful, right? And I think Americans who think about adoption think about the children as fortunate, right? That they got out of tough circumstances and are the beneficiaries of American kind of kindness and security. And I think the adoptee said, well, yes and no, right? And that there's an incredible kind of wait to be born if you are always asked to be grateful, right? And that really kind of covers over the larger context of their adoptions, right? They came out of kind of U.S. again violence in Asia. So I think one of the things that I was trying to do, especially in this chapter, is to try to kind of let the Vietnamese adoptees kind of speak or represent it as much as I could. So there's a lot of the text from the oral histories that I conducted. In terms of those reunion and heritage tours, some of them seem much more serving the cause of the organization itself, right? Either to financially benefit or to continue this idea that the United States kind of rescued children and made good in Vietnam. I should say every time, it's probably appropriate that we're doing this interview in April, you know, every time it's the anniversary of the quote fall of Saigon, there's some kind of story that I think strikes that theme of rescue. But I really kind of appreciated finding these stories of Vietnamese who were adoptees who were kind of challenging that and complicating it.
Yeah, and I do love the way that you help us think about the intersectionality of their identities, again, as you said, beyond just sort of their life histories as adoptees, but also their, you know, gender, their class, and to some extent, those identities can create complications in how they relate to one another. One of the other things I found interesting about this chapter is that there was a mention of at least one adoptee who had, I think, a sister named Birgit, who had been raised in Germany. And there were also traces of adoptees who had grown up in Australia. And I wondered to what extent was this actually then also in part an international story. You write that most of the Vietnamese adoptees did in fact settle in the United States, but you know, one of the things that they do as they organize themselves in the 90s is they begin to find, you know, branches of their families that had resettled in different, not just parts of the United States, but different parts of the world. Do you have a sense for how the Vietnamese adoptee story differs in the United States versus, say, Germany or Australia, which are, again, some of the countries that came up in your research where Vietnamese adoptees did find their way?
Oh, yeah. No, it is. I'm glad you brought that up. This, even if I'm focused upon Vietnamese adoptions by Americans and what that means for kind of a U.S.-Vietnamese experience, that adoptees landed in Europe and in Australia. There might be cases in Latin America. I haven't seen any of those. It was pretty much those two theaters. And I didn't look in detail or in a kind of comparative lens. But my sense is that when these adoptees get together across national borders, they do find kind of similar themes of a struggle to kind of fit into the national norms, a desire to know more about their pasts, and the kind of the value of seeing those connections. The way that these adoptees are kind of, they're obviously separated from one another. They're separated from their family members, but there's also really curious ways in which sometimes these adoptees also had some of their siblings remained in Vietnam and then came to the United States, sometimes as part of the Amerasian Homecoming Act. So you have, you know, siblings who are some in Vietnam, some in the United States, and then sometimes kind of connecting much later in life and noting these really powerful connections despite their very different kind of personal stories.
I really would love to have more time to talk to you about so many other parts of this book. You know, we didn't even really get a chance to talk about your methodology for oral history. I feel bad, though, because we've already taken up so much of your time. So as we wrap up, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what you're working on at the moment or what your next project is, Allison.
Sure. No, gosh, the time has gone too quickly. So I have a project that looks at the place of immigrants and the children of immigrants in Southern California's commercial restaurants since World War II. So I'm curious about kind of restaurants as spaces where different immigrant groups at a time when kind of immigration accelerated and Americans were increasingly eating out as both a convenience and then as an expression of women's new working habits, what those spaces meant in terms of the creation of immigrant communities and identities. The surprising origin of the project was actually not in an immigrant story, but in the story of Carl Karcher, of Carl's Jr. fame. It's not a restaurant I had ventured into, but the family is settled in Orange County. And so they approached Cal State Fullerton and wanted some interviews to be done. And we did those interviews, but on the condition that they would help us support a larger kind of project that collects the tales of those connected to restaurants, again, that originated in Southern California, many of them becoming national, with the idea that there's something maybe kind of special or unique about kind of the preparation of food in these public settings by immigrants. And so I've been wrestling and working with that, doing a lot of oral histories and a lot of reading. I love Mark Palenpot's new book about the flavors of empire, looking at the Thai community in LA and what food meant for it.
Yeah, and as you probably know, we featured Mark's book in February on the New Books podcast, and I agree with you. That's also a fantastic read for listeners who are interested in more about family businesses and restaurants and immigration in the 20th century. Well, Allison, I really want to thank you for being on the show today. This was such a wonderful conversation. We touched on so many things related to this topic, and I really, again, love the idea of centering the family as a site of politics and the ways in which the United States and Vietnam were intertwined in that central site. So thank you again for writing a lovely book. Thank you again for the time. For this conversation. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, well, I did. Thank you so much for your close reading and questions. And I had a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
Alrighty. Take care.
Bye-bye.
That was my conversation with Allison Barsali, professor of history at California State University Fullerton, about her new book, Children of Reunion, Vietnamese Adoptions and the Politics of Family Migrations, published in 2017 by the University of North Carolina Press. Thanks for listening to the New Books in Asian American Studies podcast. We'll see you next time.